Greeting, everyone. Welcome to our Guild 21 call. We're very excited with our speaker at this session. And I'd like to start us off with some of the industry things, one particular one that is going on at this moment, which is the Takata recall airbag. And I was researching that, and there was about 11 people who have related to the Takata airbag death in the country, I believe. And I know Takata is doing a great job, and my hat's off to Honda for jumping to all the hoops and you know, moving this thing forward and coming to a resolution. And it's and I'm sure this is not over yet. But as I was there, and I was thinking about that and how important it is. There's been 11 related deaths to this particular recall, and how manufacturers and the government are working together for the benefit of a consumer. That is very, very important. But the part that I'm sort of sitting back and thinking is why we are here, and the work that we are doing at Guild 21, the working together where insurers, shops, and manufacturers and other categories in the industry doing the right thing in promoting the safe repair. And I, you know, I cannot help it but looking at it to see how many casualties has been there by lack of us working together. In comparison to for the years and years the vehicle has been repaired, and with the technologies moving in an exponential rate, how does manufacturers, insurers, and shops are really observing that technology and implementing it into their daily work that they're doing? And if you were going to put a number on that, how many casualties have we had? And then look at the response ratio for so far 11 deaths, and now fill the blank, so far X number of deaths. In the last X number of years, we've been fixing cars because of not following the proper repair methods and doing the right things. And what kind of attention do you think the media, the industry, the government, the consumer will really put together for this fact? And if you think it's the same thing that we're getting together, then, or do you think there is a lot of sleepers that it needs to be awakened? And the question is, really the bottom line question is, are we going to wait for something to be done by outside of our industry, like a government or our legal system, to really wake us up? Or are we going to do something ourselves? And if you think you're waiting for that, then we got a long wait here, and when it does come, it's not going to be pretty. So my challenge to each and every one of us, in a, you know, not to be significant, but like really ask the question: if nobody's watching, and you're the only one responsible for all of it, what would you do with respect to repair? If you're a carrier and you are responsible to fix the car, and you are responsible to design the car, how would you react when now that you're delivering the car to customer after an accident to make sure it is the same design you did before? Or if you're a shop who you own the car and you insure the car, how would you do things differently? Or better yet, if you're an insurance company and you design the car, and you're fixing the car, giving it back to the consumer, how would you do things differently? And if you're all in one, and that is you, the person who's listening here, as a part of the industry, how would we do things differently? And if there's a gap there, this call is about the gap. So thank you for allowing me to share that with you. And we're excited about our speaker today. But before getting to our speaker and getting our team going, I'd like to bring George Avery to get us started on the oath. George, are you there?
Yes, I am. So thanks, Farzam. You know, everything that you said is spot on. And, of course, when you talk about some things that are that big and broad and where do you start, I think that's where the oath probably is something that, you know, it's on the bottom of your invitation that you've got on your email. But it's probably something you ought to print and put next to your computer or on your clipboard or on your desk, because it's something, if you look at it every day, it kind of helps focus on what Farzam talked about. So the Guild 21 oath is, we are repairers, insurers, vehicle manufacturers, and industry supporters who hereby declare the possibility of aligning our industry to a common vision that puts the consumer first. We stand for sweeping innovation. We commit to transparent and focused solutions. We are accountable to invent a radical new future where safety, efficiency, and cost-effectiveness processes, and those processes are our guiding principles. So I think that's something that's worth, I printed it, and it's something that I can look at, and it kind of helps you start your day off. So with that, we've got a great speaker today, Dan Black, and I'll turn it over to Hart.
Well, thank you, George, and I really appreciate, it was interesting, I really appreciate what Farzam said, and you, as you read the oath, it tied it together for me, which is, I'm a consumer first, particularly on these calls, I'm a consumer first. And I was thinking about how powerful these calls were actually last week on 4th of July, 4th of July weekend, which was a huge weekend for road travel. And I saw we took a road trip, and during that road trip, I think we passed about 4 accidents in about a 100-mile stretch. Total, so maybe 200-mile stretch, about 4 or 5 accidents. And what I was thinking about, because it didn't look like anyone was really hurt in any of those, but what I was thinking about was, wow, I'm so glad that in a week I get to host this call with repairers, insurers, and OEMs that are actually going to make sure those cars get fixed properly. And I really hope that all of those people are going to the people that are on this call and connected to the people that are on this call, because I know that just by showing up, each and every one of you cares that much more and are going to make that much more of a difference and make our roads that much safer and save that many more lives. And I know I bring that up every month, and it probably feels really disconnected. And the work you do is incredibly important. And so thank you so much for being here on this call, and thank you so much for being a member of the Guild and listening to the oath. So before I introduce our speaker, a couple reminders of ways that you can interact during the call. If you have a question, you can press 1 on your phone. If you have a burning question that has to be answered right now, we cannot wait, press 2 on your phone. And finally, if you like what you're hearing, please press 5 for a clap. And as I'm going through this, I already see a burning question. So James, I'm going to unmute you. Thank you for pressing 2 on your phone. James, do you have a burning question?
So the screen sharing, it says the meeting has ended. It was working a minute ago before 11.
Let me help you with that issue. There were 2 reminders. There's a little technical glitch today, so we're not using screen share. So if you looked at the reminder that came out yesterday, it has screen sharing, but we're not using it. On that one and the one today that doesn't have screen sharing, it has the PDF, and now, so I just want to say we're not using screen sharing today, and back over to you, Hart, for you to continue. Thank you.
I was going to say, you, James, that was awesome, because you both showed how beautifully the burning question works. So James pressed 2 on his phone, and we got right to him. And you read my mind because I was about to say this week no screen share, but there is an awesome slide deck. So go back to your invitation, just as Barry, our wonderful producer, said, scroll to the bottom and you'll see that you can download the presentation. So please take a moment and do that. You can also take a moment, download our speaker's bio, who I'm about to introduce. And finally, you can also download the oath from that very same email. So there's a lot of great information beyond just the phone number to call in there. So without further ado, our speaker today is Dan Black, the Global Service Support Lead for Body Cassis Paint at Fiat Chrysler Automobiles. Dan has over 17 years of experience in the collision repair industry, with 12 of them developing and validating collision repair strategies for FCA. He collaborates with design engineers and industry suppliers to provide feasible repair solutions for the collision industry and is responsible for reviewing coating and adhesive performance of collision repair materials to ensure they align with FCA specifications. On a more personal note, Dan recently got married in June, and when he did that, he was actually able, with his wife, to use one of his great passions. So he and his wife made 18 centerpieces from scratch, and those centerpieces were 24 inches wide. They were created with wood and metal. They had micro LED lights, repurposed clear wine bottles, custom taping, translucent paint, topped with seasonal flowers. They sounded absolutely spectacular. It took over 40 man hours of his life and was a month-long collaboration with his wife. And what's really cool about this is they were inspired by his love and passion for his wife and also for creating and working with those materials. And that passion bleeds through in everything he touches and everything he provides. I think you can see the very close connection between his passion for his work as well throughout this. So, without further ado, I'm very excited to introduce you to Dan. Dan, take it away.
Okay, thank you, Hart. All right. Good morning, afternoon, happy lunchtime to everyone. Thank you for joining on this great Thursday as we discuss FCA vehicles and body-on-frame repair. More or less, that's what the topic's going to be focused around. Obviously, that's just the scope of it. And I'll proceed here into slide 2 and give you more of an overview. So if we go to 2, I got to click because we're not sharing. So hold on. So slide 2, we have FCA vehicles equipped with full frames, body-on-frame design characteristics, repair methodology when working with full frames, and vehicle-specific scenarios when repairing full frames or at least working with full-frame vehicles in general. On slide 3, upcoming, these are the vehicles that we have that currently are a body-on-frame design. We have all of our truck platforms, which include the Ram 1500, 2500, 3500, 5500, Jeep Wrangler, and Ram ProMaster. On the Ram 3500 and 4500, 5500, there's an opportunity to do some upfitting. Obviously, you can see that in 4500s and 5500s. There is, you have a loader on the back, a multitude of accessories, so all the heavy equipment vehicles, everything that you need to be a workhorse out in the field, whether you're working oil rigs, so on and so forth. These vehicles are going to take a lot of abuse. So it's essential that they are structurally reinforced to handle all scenarios in adverse terrain or perhaps for areas where they have to create their own terrain. Jeep Wrangler is always synonymous with off-roading. It is a full-frame vehicle, so it can handle a lot of dynamic loads. And then the Ram ProMaster is our cargo product, and that what you'll see is upfitted for most commercial properties such as a plumber, construction worker, so on and so forth, something that's more utility-based, but also being fuel efficient at the same time because it does have a smaller drivetrain, so it's a little bit more focused on the residential provider for additional cargo, but yet fuel efficient at the same time. So it helps with economics in that instance. So we will go into slide four. Slide 4, we're just discussing body-on-frame design characteristics. So more or less, I think everyone's fully aware because full-frame has been here for a very long period of time. You can see by that call out in the image that the shell essentially floats over the frame. And in this instance, it's a Jeep Wrangler, so the top is removable, so it shows those particular components floating too. But it, as you can see, it's a rolling chassis. You can literally disconnect the vehicle, and you can steer a full chassis independently and have the body removed if you really wanted to. So I know everyone's very familiar with this. Being in the collision industry, it's nothing new, nothing mind-blowing, but it's something that we continue to do today because it's design is proven and it's efficient for the practical applications that we implement it for. So from a structural support standpoint, design intent, like I said, is always to handle adverse conditions where typically unibody won't be able to dynamically be the best fit for that application. So where you do have a scenario that's going to require additional tow load capacity, so on and so forth, be more of a workhorse than just a commercial A to B transportation vehicle. This is something more of a design intent, although Jeep Wrangler has looked at somewhat of a commuter vehicle. The other ones are specifically designed to handle a certain type of application, whether it's towing a specific payload, getting your jet skis to the beach, or maybe you're towing a two-car trailer, something of that nature. So you just have a very large plethora of things to work through and to ensure the vehicle is still in its intent and its basically it will not deteriorate too quickly, and it can handle many loads and adverse terrain. The impact load, it can handle very well because it is a well-designed frame. We have a multitude of different strategies that were designed into it to handle other conditions. As with all our vehicles, they are adhered to the IHSS safety standards. And traditionally, you can get a lower cost of repair in the front end just because certain components there are serviceable where they may not have been in the past, and we are continuing to always work with that. The complexity, substrate material, like I said, it's high strength steel. The complexity is really not there because it's relatively the same as it's been for so many years. Most of our designs are typically ladder frames, so there's nothing that's really out of the box. It's a proven system. Everybody pretty much knows how to work on it. Thankfully, in this scenario, if working with the frame, you're not dealing with the high complexity of different substrates where unique processes and welders are absolutely necessary. Yes, certain equipment's required, but it's not as much of an investment when working with the vehicle body shell, so to say, the body in white portion of the vehicle. Go to slide five. So slide five just kind of gives you more of an overview in terms of how we work things in the plant with full frame. We use a lot of principal point location. We call them PLP. That's just the acronym, so I'm just calling it out for what it is. It's more or less the centering point for where you're going to measure from point to point to determine that the vehicle's true, it's within specification, the body's not twisted, and if you are making adjustments, you know where you need to be in relation to the cross-car dynamics of the vehicle. So at least you know it will fit well to the frame since it is independent if you are transferring the body to another frame, or in the instance of we are straightening a frame, everything is relative. So you do have different dimensions in which you measure to ensure everything is within specification. So there are two-way and four-way locating holes, and that just helps you provide for ample adjustment in the assembly process. There's transferring pins. The transferring pins are quite unique in the assembly process. They're actually quite innovative. If you can imagine like a vice grip, and when you are basically opening it up, when you do the opening action, it lowers a pin, and then when you close it, it lifts the pin. So when they're assembling in the plant, it provides for concise placement. So that way we have consistency and we drive it forward, and it actually enhances our quality. So in essence, everybody wins by integrating these processes into our assembly portion, and then we know that the vehicle frame and the body is true as well if everything aligns correctly from those PLP points and those pins. So it provides consistency. Unibody dimensionally shaped and foundation of the vehicle is taken from the vehicle ladder in the body white application. All that really means, you can see in this call out, this image on the bottom of slide five in the right corner, that is actually a ladder style. You'll see that in a lot of applications where we just have what look like cross members coming across, and then you would backfill with your floor and so forth, but you also have your side supports, so the lower apertures are in place, so the ladder frame is more or less the integrity, the ladder style is the integrity of the body in white shell, and then you build out from there and up. So you need to ensure that's within specification first and foremost, and then you build up and outward. Okay, slide six, moving on. So a quick question for the audience. I believe, Hart, hopefully you're ready. It's an AB question. Is the use of heat permitted when repairing FCA vehicles?
So if the answer is yes, press 1 on your phone. If the answer is no, press 2 on your phone. So is the use of heat permitted when repairing FCA vehicles? Press 1 for yes and 2 for no. And they're coming in. So 1 for yes, 2 for no. And they're slowly coming in. And it looks like we have about 60% for no and about 40% for yes. So 40% think yes, we can.
Okay.
And about 30 to 40% say yes, little more say no.
Okay, let's proceed to slide 7 then. Let's go to 7. And here you will see our position statement regarding the use of heat during a collision repair. Heat is permitted when repairing Chrysler vehicles or FCA vehicles, but it's only permitted when you are attaching it to a point, when you're applying it to an area on the vehicle, that particular component and the components that are affected by the heat zone are replaced. So you can utilize it when straightening a frame and so forth, as long as the component that you're heating is replaced after the straightening process. So in certain instances, cold pull is only going to take you so far. You can use heat to get to the extra area, but you must ensure anything that you've applied that heat to is replaced in those scenarios. That's the position across all of our vehicles. So we understand that certain types of impact zones and areas are so severe that it almost might be, it will exceed the limitations of the equipment you're working with in order to get within those specifications when straightening using a cold pull. So heat would be required in those instances, but we must have a service component available to replace that component that you are heating. That's essential. And if you have any more questions about heat during repair on FCA vehicles, you can always refer to our position statement. It's hosted within Collision Bulletin 31-001-11. And it remains, even though it was published in 2011, it still reflects today's vehicles as well. So let's proceed to slide 8. Slide 8, where you are discussing here, it's repair methodology continued. While some salvage parts may appear equivalent, there can be dramatic differences in design and functional characteristics, which will not be determined by a visual inspection and could have a negative effect on vehicle occupants in a future collision event. So what this is more or less saying, we do not endorse the usage of salvage components because we do not know what they've been subjected to over time. They could have been subjected to adverse environments during that time the vehicle's been stored, and if that vehicle was clipped or so on and so forth, we don't want to become a portion of that liability. So we're always vested in replacing the components with OEM parts that are replacements distributed by FCA, not salvage components. So the service part is always recommended in these instances because we can always ensure that the vehicle will perform as designed if another impact is resulted. So if vehicles involve another type of impact, we can always have confidence in knowing that it's going to perform as designed in those instances. Otherwise, it may be diminished because we don't know what can occur to that component over time, or if there was a potential where that may have been reworked in the past. There's also situations where that component could have been recalled, and it's very difficult to trace that. Okay, slide 9, going forward. Just this kind of gives you frame rail equipment requirements, more or less welding specifications, so the ensuring that the welder is capable of performing this particular application with these settings and must have the capabilities outlined, as in slide 9. So electrode type, the size, the wire speed rate, as well as the voltage, the polarity, the electric stickout. All these specifications are specifically called out in a collision repair manual information. Always refer to MopartRepairConnection.com for any vehicle you're repairing because the welding specifications are always detailed in our collision repair manuals. Now, this is just an instance of using GMAW. We do have flux core as well as other welding equipment specifications. So, and then we have MIG braze requirements as well. So when you reference that content, it's just, it's not limited to GMAW. We also have plug weld sizes based on the tier stackup you're utilizing, whether it's a two-tier, a three-tier, a single tier. When doing sheet metal repairs to the exterior of the vehicle, the plug weld diameter, as well as, you guessed it, the wire requirement, as well as the gas type, which in most cases when MIG welding on your typical sheet metal, it is a 75% argon, 25% CO2 mix. That's something that's generally standard in the industry, but just want to reemphasize that. And then the last bullet point just reemphasizes what I just stated regarding repair content. Always refer to MoparRepairConnection.com. MoparRepairConnection.com is also accessible if you go to OEMOneStop.com and click on any one of our brands. It will redirect you to MoparRepairConnection.com. And the nice caveat of MoparRepairConnection.com is that it's free. There is no fees. You just sign up with your email and a password, and you have complete access to all of our collision repair content that is on that website. Okay, continuing to slide 10. Of frame repair methodology, you must remove all components to access the structural damage to accurately assess it, evaluate the damage of the frame, ensure it's on a level surface, such as a frame machine, begin measuring with 3D measurement equipment to confirm the severity. 3D measurement equipment has worked out really well in terms of the industry just because it can have all these ideal PLP locators that the frame equipment providers have identified within their systems, but using our specifications have made that relative. So some might have color image references, and then others have positioning where you have a hanger that's hanging from a particular PLP point, and they can do a cross-dimensional measurement, and it's measuring as you're pulling, which is just, in that instance, it's wonderful because it takes a lot of the guesswork out of it. It increases efficiencies and so forth. Okay, you always want to anchor your vehicle in accordance with your frame equipment provider's recommendations. When operating a frame machine, be sure to follow the safety procedures. As hopefully we're all aware, there is a lot of safety protocols we must be aware of when working with those towers on a frame machine and ensuring that those loads are amply applied to the vehicle and we're not overloading it and potentially slipping of clamps and so forth and creating any potential for serious injury. And as I've stated earlier, we always want to begin with cold pulling the frame. Cold pulling is highly advised. In the instance that cold pulling cannot achieve the specifications which we outlined, we recommend using heat, but only on components that you can replace after heating them. Okay, so it's slide 11. So here's a scenario for when would frame replacement be necessary. Obviously, when frame is beyond repair, if it has a severe diamond condition, just any instance where repair isn't feasible. So in the instance of sectioning procedures that are not published by the manufacturer, there's no serviceable components for that particular impact area, service parts have not been released to support, such as the mounts, frame rail tips, cross members, etc. Like, this is where we get into that whole staple of salvage parts. We want to be very conscientious that generally, if the service part's not released and readily available, it was due to a safety-type concern from the OEM. So we always want to ensure that if there isn't the component's not released by the manufacturer or not available through the manufacturer after contacting them, that you must proceed with the next viable option, which generally means frame replacement. So here's another quick question to everybody. What percentage of front frame rail tips are replaced compared to full frames on Ram 1500s? So the frame rail tip sections in the front as opposed to an entire frame assembly underneath a Ram 1500. And Hart, you can take this or I can read it off.
Sure. Well, so A, press 1 on your phone if you think it's 82% frame rail trip, 18% frame. Press 2 on your phone if you think it's 76% frame rail tip, 24% frame. Press 3 on your phone if you think it's 64% versus 36%. Or D on your phone, or sorry, 4, you don't have a D on your phone, 4 on your phone if it's 53% frame rail tip versus 47% frame. So press 1 if you think it's 82% frame. 2 if you think it's 76% frame, 3 if you think it's 64% frame, and 4 if you think it's 53% frame. So they're coming in. We only have about half of you voting. So if you have no idea, press 5 so we can see that all of you are voting. So again, press 1 if it's 82%, 2 if it's 76% frame, 3 if it's 64% frame, and 4 if it's 53% frame. It's really interesting. We have, goodness, we have almost 50% saying A, 82% frame real tip. We have very few, let's say about another 10, 15% selecting B, 76%. We have a lot less, this is our lowest percentage, about 5% picking C, 64% frame. We have another 10, 15% with D, 53% frame. And we have a whopping 30% that just don't know.
Okay. That's very honest. I appreciate that. So as the majority of the industry has selected A, A is correct. 82% of frame rail tips are a comparison to 18% frames. So that's what we have in terms of volume. As you know, based on all of the potential potential answers, we obviously replace more frame rail tips than frames. It's just a matter of how much and what's the ratio. And that gives you a great depiction of where it is and how valuable it is to have front frame rail tips based on the occurrences and how good sectioning procedures are to have that are validated and processed by an OEM as opposed to a complete full frame replacement, because in many instances that could result in a very negative instance for the customer. They may no longer have a vehicle, it could be towed, and so forth. So we always want to ensure the longevity of the product, but also that the impact resistance that we've designed in there initially is retained, and we always validate that. So I just want to emphasize how much value has been provided to the industry. Okay, so when assessing body and white damage, you want to measure all your doors, underhood, underbody, cross vehicle, glass openings to verify the dimensions are within specification. If anything's skewed, you might have a twist condition in the body and white sheet metal, and that needs to be addressed before you begin doing any swapping and so forth. You just want to ensure that everything's within specification, it's good to go, and because when you bring it over to the frame, you want to ensure that it's within alignment. Now, you want to measure your replacement frame to ensure it's within dimensional specification as well, because you never know. I mean, in these instances, you're working in a shop environment, you measure the body, you go to fit it to the frame, and the holes don't line up. Is that a design intent? Can it be off a couple millimeters? What's going on? Always ensure A to B. Is it the body? Is it the frame? Where did we begin? Where should we be? We always reference the collision repair manual to ensure that vehicle's within specification, both body and white, and the new frame assembly. Okay. So body on frame repair for a Ram pickup truck. This is a front frame rail tip replacement, which kind of leads in from that previous question. Most of us are aware in order to access these areas, we must remove a multitude of components, a lot of suspension components and so forth, to access the front frame rails, particularly on a Ram pickup truck. You want to remove all the welds securing the front frame rail, the tips to the frame, which include the weld that is around the perimeter of the frame rail at the seam, which is in the lower right corner there, that image. That is the seam where the weld is typically located. And you can see that in callout number 2 on the left image. That is where the weld is located to remove, as well as a little plug fillet weld that is on the side of the frame rail, and it's an oval shape. So that also needs to be removed with a die grinder or a plasma cutter. In these instances, never use an oxyacetylene torch, because what we're trying to do here is if you apply it with heat, you're actually affecting the other rail, which we do not want to get into replacing, because that's going to result in a full frame replacement if we apply heat in that area, excessive heat, which would be an oxyacetylene torch. So we want to ensure that heat is minimized, so we're using a plasma cutter or a die grinder or perhaps a reciprocating saw to remove the frame rail from the frame assembly. The frame rail tip, sorry. So we're going to proceed to slide 13. Okay, another question. On which SCA vehicles is it acceptable to apply weld-through primer? And I can list this off. I think hopefully everyone gets the trend of where we're going. Ram 1500, Jeep Wrangler, Chrysler 300 for A, press 1. For B, press 2. That would be a Jeep Renegade, Jeep Compass, Ram ProMaster, Alfa Romeo Giulia, and the new Alfa Romeo Stelvio, which just hit our market a couple days ago. And then press number 3 for C, Dodge Challenger, Jeep Grand Cherokee, and Chrysler 200, or select D, number 4, press 4 for D, none of the above.
All right. Thank you, Dan. So press your phones, or press the buttons on your phones. I'm not seeing any hands up yet. So Barry, producer extraordinaire, I don't know if they're not coming in, but right now the hands do not seem to be coming through.
Okay,
so
I see
press one for A.
Yeah, I see them on my end.
All right, would you like to share the results?
Sure. So number one, which is the Ram 1500, is 3%. Number two, which is the Jeep Wrangler and Compass and the Ram and Alfa Romeo, is 1%. Number three, which is the Dodge Challenger and the Grand Cherokee and the Chrysler 200, is 1%. And number four, none of the above, is a whopping 31%. And number five, not sure, is 3%. So the winner is none of the above. How accurate is that, Dan?
That's precise. I'm glad to hear that. I actually am. So at least everyone understands from working with, or majority of our audience understands when working with FCA vehicles, that we do not permit the use of weld-through primer. That has always been a statement of ours, and we stand behind that. And just to reinforce it, we do have documentation that reflects proper processing of vehicles beyond weld-through primers. Because what we've always found with weld-through primers, it does contaminate the weld area. So our engineers have always guided us and told us that they're not comfortable using the product in those applications based on the results they have seen. So we have always went down the path of never advising to use weld-through primer on our vehicles. Okay. Thank you, everyone. So next slide, slide 14, we have the additional processes for sectioning the frame rail. So this is where we're going to basically dry fit the new frame rail tip, but we always want to ensure that we smooth and square cut the edges on the pre-existing area of the frame to ensure it's beveled so it can accept the new weld properly. We always want to make sure it has that nice chamfer on there and it's clean, it's not contaminated. And then we'll dry fit the new frame rail assembly and make any adjustments as necessary, but always going back and referencing our specifications to ensure it's within that parameter. And then remove all internal OEM E-coat. This is important because we want to ensure the E-coat is removed within 25 millimeters of the weld joint to limit any type of potential contamination. We want to make sure we get good weld penetration when working through with the front frame rail tip sectioning. So in those instances, it is advised highly to remove the E-coat area so we get good weld penetration, and then we'll always backfill the coatings later on in this process. And then when correctly aligned, we just tack weld the frame rail tip in place. Then we verify again with measurements to ensure where we need to be. Better off tacking before you do a skip stitch, because skip stitch is going to be a heck of a lot more intrusive to remove and refit the frame rail if it is out of specification. So it's always best to tack weld, assess where the frame rail is in location and everything else. Once it's properly fitted, then you come back with your skip stitch process, which is just after we do the plug weld on that fillet area. So you want to apply a MIG plug weld 3 into the plug weld hole on the replacement frame rail tip. That's the oval portion that we pointed out earlier with the die grinder removal or the plasma cutter. And then we just start the MIG weld process and do a nice fillet weld all the way around the perimeter, and that would be sufficient. So let's move to slide 15. Slide 15.
Dan?
Yes.
Dan, I have a quick question. This is Farzam. My question is, why do you remove 25 millimeter from weld zone area? Why would you do that?
So you want to remove the E-coat portion to ensure you get at least good fitment of the frame rail, but primarily it's for the weld zone. So the heat-affected zone from the weld will burn back into that coating. So So if we remove at least 25 millimeters of it, we can ensure successful weld penetration and the integrity of that weld when going through the repair process.
So it's almost the same principle why you don't want to use weld for primer kind of a thing, yeah?
Exactly, yes. That's exactly what it aligns with. It's reducing weld contamination, yep. We're eliminating weld contamination in that instance.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for clarification.
You're welcome. Yeah, so slide 15 here emphasizes the skip stitch method where you apply just a small portion of the weld and then you go to a different portion of the frame, apply another portion of the weld, you're skip stitching so you reduce the heat affecting zone to eliminate any distortion in the rail and so forth. So you weld the joint one closure at a time and then you confirm alignment of the frame rail placement again. So you always want to ensure that frame rail is within specification. So it's measuring twice, in this case, you're going to measure three times. Go to slide 16. So then you would appropriately dress the weld area, apply corrosion-resistant coatings inside and out. What that entails is an epoxy primer as well as a cavity wax. Hopefully everyone's familiar with cavity wax. It can be applied with a wand. The wand has a 360-degree orifice, which when you place it in the center of the rail, keep it elevated, it will accurately coat 360 degrees the entire inner frame rail to provide ample corrosion protection, such as the area where we remove the e-coat will now actively protect that area as well from the inside of the frame rail assembly. And then we are applying additional primers and so forth on the outside, restoring the frame rail to its original condition with the ample coatings, and apply top coat. And then you've completed the repair. Then you can reassemble all the other components, and everything should fit accordingly. And then you can reinstall your radiator support and so forth, and then your fender alignment will be there as well as the hood. I'm running short on time, so I'm going to have to speed through a couple things. I didn't realize it would take me this long. I'm going to skip ahead here real quickly and get to some essential points. So I'm going to go to slide 19, so you can go with me to slide 19. We have, on the Jeep Wrangler, it's unique. We have a vehicle that has a body in white on our frame, but essentially it has a removable roof system, and that body is floating on the vehicle. And in comparison to a truck cab, that's got a fixed roof. So in fixed roof, there's not much shifting or lateral movement, fore and aft and so forth on the vehicle. If you do remove the sport bar from the Jeep Wrangler assembly, you will start to see some deviation in the windshield header frame as well as the B-pillar. They can begin to deviate. The moment those supports are removed, you have removed all upper support of the vehicle, and they are bolt-on assemblies. So if something has occurred with that vehicle or if they're just slightly loosened, it can shift the alignment of the body. And that's very critical to understand because in those instances, sport bar replacement might be required in certain impacts, but it's always important to maintain the integrity of those measurements in those areas, and you can quickly find yourself in a bind with door gap and so forth and hood alignment because the body does tend to start to deviate quite quickly when that entire upper support system is removed. And just some quick notes to adjust that. I'm going to speed up to, let's go to slide 22. Slide 22 has you removing torque fasteners on the windshield header as well as sport bar fasteners and so forth, because in this instance we're going to adjust the windshield header frame. So that entire frame, we're going to adjust it within specification because it may have twisted. In the instance it's twisted, you want to remove these components, but you always must ensure you're within tolerance of our gap specifications. So throughout the process, it's best advised to have an assistant. The assistant will monitor the process with a plastic feeler gauge, which is emphasized on slide 23. And as you can see on slide 23, you're actually using a ratchet strap. It's critical not to wrap the strap around any sport bar in the upper area that goes across to the B-pillar. Just attach it at the little footman loops. And once you have it through the loops and slightly sash them in place, you are able to apply a little bit of load and apply a little load, measure, let it go back to muscle memory, apply it again, let it spring back. So you're just probably trying to play a little deviation there with the windshield frame to ensure you can get it back within specification. And it might be on the right side, it might be on the left side, it could be both sides. but you only want to work one side at a time and ensure it's within that gap tolerance from the A-pillar to the door. And if we skip ahead to slide 25, we actually have a gap tolerance for the cowl to windshield frame area. So between those two different specifications, those are critical to keep in alignment because they are essential features for roof panel alignment as well. So we have a soft top assembly as well as a freedom panel assembly, and those can quickly deviate if the windshield header frame is not within specification. And that can create a great headache because you don't know what the vehicle was like prior to that pre-accident condition you just had as a result of the collision. So you don't know if the roof panel was off initially to begin with. And that could have been a potential, depending upon how the vehicle was shipped to the customer or what other type of collateral could have happened throughout the use of the vehicle prior to that collision. And slide 26, you can see additional tie-down locations to get additional ratchet tie-down support, as well as additional measurement checks in slide 27. And then real quickly, in slide 28, we have a measurement for a fore-aft condition. This is for the freedom panels. In some instances, you might find that the freedom panel is a little bit more set back on the right side compared to the left side, and vice versa. The left side could be more offset to the right. So you want to work with that scenario. There is an adjustment process for that as well, but it involves adjusting the B-pillar location. So if we go to slide 29, there are fasteners at the top of the vehicle. You loosen those. And if you apply sufficient force with the assistance of a helper on slide 30, you can relocate the positioning of where the tie downs are for the support bar in relationship to the B pillar to get the proper movement to have those panels back within that proper alignment. And that's all I have. I just tried to speed that up.
Well, thank you, Dan. We do probably have another 10 minutes or so if you wanted to go back and add some and cover some of the things that you skipped. And while you're sort of contemplating that, I'd love to turn it back to the audience and see if anybody has any specific questions for Dan. If you have a specific question, could you please press 1 on your phone? So if anyone has a question for Dan, please press 1 on your phone. And I'm not seeing Barry. I think my internet's back up. I just want to confirm.
Right,
oh, we do have a question from James again. James, you are live.
Yeah, I've got a question about. I think there's some Rams that are like this, for an example, but some of the Durangos as well and things like that. But there's a hydroform rail, which is kind of like part of the upper rail. There's usually two of them. And I've had some questions about these rails as to whether or not they're repairable. I've heard different answers. I've heard if it's damaged, you have to section it. I've heard they're repairable. It'd be nice to have kind of an answer with that.
Yes. I'm going to confirm for you right now. I am almost entirely 100% certain you can section the hydroform rail on the upper on the Ram trucks. The Ram 1500 specifically. I am just confirming that at this moment.
Yeah, I know there's a sectioning procedure. I'm just wondering if there is a repair procedure. Like if it's dented, can that be repaired or does it have to be sectioned?
Oh, in that instance, it would have to be sectioned because of the hydroform process. We're losing some of the integrity of the metal. So the metallurgy is actually compromised when it's dented. So if you were to pull it back, it's lost muscle or metal memory, so to say. Although it returns, we are losing some of those impact variables that are necessary in those areas. So in essence, you would have to section if it had any subsequent damage. So if it looked like a golf ball-sized dent or something like that, the rail was formed to a certain degree to handle ample loads, and we know if we section in those areas, it will be reinstated. But if the rail has basically suffered any other type of impact, such as a dent, it could compromise it. So, yeah, there is no repair process to answer that.
Great. Thank you. Do we have any other questions? Please press 1 on your phone.
I do have a question.
Thank you, Farzan.
Sure. Dana, I understand that I was wondering if you can elaborate on your free information online that
okay.
people can just go there, because there's only two manufacturers in the world today that they have free information of their collision online, and you're one of them. And what I would like to know, why do you do that? And for our audience, how do they get there and actually get a free information that are specific to your car right on your site? If you please.
Yeah, so we provide it for free because we want to ensure the technician has the proper information at their fingertips. We don't want to make it difficult for a technician to access the content. We want to ensure there's no discrepancies. Hey, I have to pay $15 a day to access certain content. We want to ensure it's easily accessible to repair the vehicle correctly, because it's both of our customers at stake. It's the customer's safety and livelihood, and we always want to ensure that's done correctly, but we never want to hear excuses. So the fact that the information is available for free, it's intentional. We always want to keep it that way. It drives traffic. It's at MoparRepairConnection.com. You can also access it through OEMOneStop.com. I always say OEMOneStop.com because OEMOneStop.com has other manufacturers listed on their site, which helps direct you to their repair content. Even though it may not be free, it gives you a portal to access it. And that same mechanism drives you to MoparRepairConnection.com when clicking on one of our five or six brands. And in that instance, when you do get to the main screens, it appears you have to set an account, which you do, but what's nice is that you don't have to pay for the account. You just set your email, establish a password, and you have full access to all of our repair content, as well as position statements and other ancillary documents that we've released over time, as well as collision bulletins.
Wow, that is really fantastic to hear and really lines up with the Guild's values. So it's wonderful to hear that that's something that you provide. So thank you. We have another question for you. It's from John, and I apologize if I mess up your last name, Huter. You are on the line, John.
Yeah, just a quick question on the heat process for the frame.
Yes.
Why wouldn't you just replace the part, since you have to do that anyway once you've heated it? I mean, I guess what's the benefit? I'm a little unfamiliar with the frame straightening practice.
Well, the only instance there is if there is impact that is beyond the zone of the new replacement part. So say there is a collision-impacted area that could be straightened within specification and is not compromised, then you could straighten that area with that frame rail tip. And in some instances, the frame could be out of alignment beyond the point of that frame rail tip sectioning location. So you can use the existing crumple zone to pull you within that specification that might be further down the frame assembly and get you within that alignment, and then you could section the frame rail tip. But the heat is at the discretion of the technician. So
it's more than, okay. All right.
It's relating to areas beyond the point of replacement. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Cool. Thanks.
Thank you, John. And do we have any other questions? All right. So we have about 5 minutes left. Dan, I know we raced through at the end. Is there anything you wanted to go back and touch upon? Or does George, do you have a question?
George?
Oh, no, Dan, go right ahead.
Okay. I sped through it, but I just gave you a general basis. I just wanted to make everyone aware that we have a process for adjusting the Jeep Wrangler, and specifically because it is such a unique vehicle and the way it's been designed. It's the only vehicle on the market with a foldable windshield. I don't know of anybody else that has a bolt-on windshield that you can literally fold down if you wanted to and maintain its integrity. That blows my mind. But in that instance, I just wanted to draw more notice to it because it does create some differences for repair scenarios, and you have to have a different type of methodology when approaching it. And the specifications are there, so I think it's pretty detailed, and they're absolutely readily available for anyone to access. That's all I really had. I mean, the specs are there, the detail, the gap and flush, so to help everyone out, I just wanted to ensure that it was communicated accordingly to assist with any instances where you might have variables with this product. It has been on the market for about 10 years now. So.
Dan, I have another question for you, if I may. in regards with your Jeep Wranglers and convertible Jeeps, when the car gets hit, the frame is damaged. In your recommendation, we've had some facilities contact us with some challenge on how do you properly pull that, considering the roof is not there, and how do you properly anchor it down? Do you have any? This is a too deep of a question, then we can definitely take it offline as well. But what's your recommendation is with your property pulling that, so you're not, it's secured first before you apply pull, so you're not creating further damage in existing rails that are even undamaged.
Right. I mean, most definitely needs to be anchored, and the anchoring points are going to be, it'll vary based on the repair scenario, obviously. And you're going to vary with the equipment provider, too, based on the equipment they have available to anchor the vehicle. But I would have to get back to you on specific anchoring location. Yeah. But back to you on that.
So your recommendation is really follow each particular one in an anchoring position. And one of the challenges we've had dealing with facilities when they're fixing these vehicles is they just, you know, not to jump in and just do a regular anchoring on these vehicles, because considering the way they're designed, and if you're not properly anchoring them, then as you're pulling them, you're really bending other parts of the vehicle without you even knowing it. That's been something we've noticed out there, but thank you for further solidifying and underlining its follow to anchoring points that are very, very important here.
I do understand your concern, and I will have to follow back up with you on that detail.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Dan, and thank you, Farzam. We actually have a couple more questions, but we are reaching the end of our time. So I think maybe we could squeeze in one very, very, very quick question. Oh. Okay, I think we can squeeze in one quick question, and it is Chris Stewart. Chris, you're on the line. Quick question, quick answer.
Hi, Dan. Great information. On your slide 14, you have the plug weld example. And there's some debate, depending on who you talk to, about if you started outside in or from the inside out. Could you further explain the plug weld data that you have there?
Hmm. Yeah, we don't have that detail specified. I mean, from our instance, we used to industry best practice for applying a plug weld. We never really got into the detail of the exact application in terms of outer or starting from the inner. That's a great question. But the general principle in this case, obviously you're doing a counterclockwise pattern, but that doesn't really assist you with where do you start, on the outside edge or inside edge. I would assume you want to be closest to the mating surfaces of the metal. So you want to have that welding torch pointed at the adjacent seams of the frame rail tip as well as the inner frame rail. So it looks like it would
great.
Be
thank you.
Yep, you're welcome.
Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for being on the call this lovely, warm July day. We are taking a break for August. We're all taking summer vacation, so there will be no call in August. However, our next call will be in September, September 14th at 11 a.m. Pacific. Just a reminder, we are taking August off. I also want to remind you that we have the official dates for the 9th Annual Symposium taking place Monday, February 12th and 13th in Newport Beach. So we're really looking forward to hopefully seeing you in person there. And have a wonderful summer. Thank you.